You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 6th, 2021, my 9th. My name is Emma Bigland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. You know, the nine is just the six, upside down. We are broadcasting live as steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matthew Stewart, author of the 99%, or the 9.9%, wow, it's not my day thus far. The new aristocracy that is entrenching inequality and warping our culture. Meanwhile, two Senate Democrats, John Tester and Joe Manchin, of course, joined Senate Republicans yesterday in voting to overturn Biden's vaccine mandate that isn't like a mandate. It has testing for private businesses. Luckily, the bill has to go to the House, and Democratic leadership doesn't even expect to dignify it with a vote. So the Holy Pontiff parliamentarian is expected to make her decree on immigration reform known shortly. As House progressives encourage the Senate to overrule their built-in excuse, you'd need to get all 50 Democrats on that. So, gonna be tough. The House also voted 428-1. The lone vote for no was the Republican Thomas Massie to ban imported products from Xinjiang over the Chinese prosecution of Muslim ethnic minorities, but we still have not gotten that censure vote on Boebert's Islamophobia. Interesting. This also comes as the UK and Canada join the US in a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Beijing Olympics. Former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows has decided to sue Nancy Pelosi and the January 6th committee hours after a criminal contempt of Congress referral was filed against him. The best offense is a good defense, or no, best defense is a good offense. That's what I meant. And lastly, the 16-year Angela Merkel era is officially over in Germany. It was an era marked by austerity and wage and labor suppression. Olaf Scholz of the center-left Social Democratic Party was sworn in as German chancellor yesterday after successfully forming a government with the Green Party and the Liberals. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully I got all of my Samisms out of the way, where I say things wrong. That's, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know. Emma preps by hanging upside down like a vampire bat from the ceiling, so she has troubles with the sixes and the nines.
Yep. It's how I basically sleep as well. I incubate. So I'm looking forward to our discussion in a little bit, but We like to start off the show sometimes with serious clips, but sometimes with silly clips, and just sometimes bat, no pun intended, based on my sleeping patterns, clips. This is one of those. Tucker Carlson spoke with former Brexit party leader Nigel Farage on his daytime show the other day. Nigel doesn't even get the nighttime portion, but this is where Tucker kind of launders his craziest stuff. Also, you know, you'll see guests that he doesn't feel are primetime guests, but have the ability to heighten the insanity level of the conversation. And so he'll plug this Fox Nation show on his nighttime show, and he's able to maintain, I don't even know what respectability he might have, but just trust me, the even crazier stuff is said on this daytime show.
Yeah, it's Tucker's true heart. Mm-hmm. It's where he has like Charles Murray on and stuff like that.
Right. And so here he is with Nigel Farage talking about Prime Minister of the UK, Boris Johnson, and basically critiquing him on COVID from the right. And Tucker has a interesting theory on why Boris Johnson isn't living up to his own COVID-denying standards.
Leadership quality.
Yes.
We're going to go and climb that hill. And here's why we want to do it. And we invite you, the public, to come with us on that journey.
Amen.
That is leadership. And Boris, just with the best will in the world, doesn't have that. And we've seen more U-turns in policy from a Johnson government than I've seen in any government in my lifetime.
Yes.
And
in a very embarrassing way.
Oh, some of it's been shocking.
So somebody who knows him told me, and I should be initially getting your take on this.
I just love the concept of a U-turn in an embarrassing way. Oh, would we be even more embarrassing than driving on the right side of the road?
I love the idea that U-turns are this just damning thing for a politician to undertake, particularly during a pandemic of a novel virus.
Yeah, it's almost like when you take in new data, you might change your position. That's nuts.
You react to events on the ground. And, you know, when you're a Tory, it's tough because you're, you know, degenerate aristocracy. But you do the best job you can. And I think Boris should deserve support, again, from these, just from these kind of creeps.
Yeah, I mean, but Boris maybe went a little too far for them in, you know, he dresses up like he pretends to be one of the men of the people. Oh, I'll wear a police outfit. Any excuse for me to break out the accent, but we go back a little.
Government in my lifetime.
Yes.
And
in a very embarrassing way.
Oh, some of it's been shocking.
So somebody who knows him told me, and I should be initially getting your take on this, that getting COVID emasculated him. It changed him. It feminized him. It weakened him as a man. Do you think that's...
Well, I think he was very seriously ill.
Yo, for sure he was.
And I think... I mean, one of the things we have learned from COVID is people who are 50, 60, 70, 80 pounds overweight tend to have fared very badly.
Sure.
Now, we don't talk about it
but
much.
But the virus itself, this is true, does tend to take away the life force in some people, I notice. I mean, it does feminize people. No one ever says that, but it's true.
I think the virus did affect him, but I think, let's be honest about it, it's the new wife, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, Carrie Johnson, or as she's now called, Carrie Antoinette, which even the historians like. This is a very powerful, very strong woman.
What wife is this, do we know? Or do we even keep count? I don't...
Well, that's not the...
So, I mean, it could be his wife. It could be his wife that's feminizing him just like COVID. I mean, you might call her a novel virus in and of herself.
Sorry, COVID does have some side effects. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, impotence and infertility is one of those. And
there's a fear that men are going to do the long COVID. We don't know since, sorry to cut you off, but we don't know since it's a novel virus, there's a fear that the sperm count is going to be irreparably lowered.
Yeah, like that's an important reason to get vaccinated, actually, if for like future family planning purposes, if you're a male. And I'd also just, what was the other thing? Oh crap, I lost my train of thought.
No, it's okay. I mean, he basically, what stuck out to me there is, for Tucker Carlson, if you're weakened, if you lose weight, you're female. Life force is what he described as what is taken from you when you get COVID. While the entire time, Tucker Carlson is saying, I'm not telling you not to get vaccinated, but here's why it would be incredibly dangerous for you to get vaccinated. Put that aside. Like, the idea, people are pointing out the absurdity of these comments, of course, but there is... The underlying, like, homophobia and sexism in it is unbelievable. Well, life force is inherently male, so, like, life is, to Tucker Carlson, I mean, he said the term life force is a male enterprise.
He's recoding the symptoms of getting this virus in this, like, homophobic and misogynistic way, right? Like, long COVID symptoms where you feel, you know, like, I don't know if people don't know people with long COVID, but... I was talking to people around Thanksgiving. My mom knows three people that have long COVID, and they just mentally, they're in a fog. Like, that's not something I associate with femininity.
Yeah.
That's like some neurological thing happening because you had a crazy virus attack your nervous system. And
but you don't associate it with femininity because you are not a...
I guess I don't.
...raisin sexist. I mean, the people that are active, the people that are making things happen... that's inherently male to somebody like Tucker Carlson. And even Farage was trying to steer the conversation away from COVID is feminizing you. And then let's also be clear. This fits perfectly in what Tucker Carlson has been trying to say for such a long time, that the United States, like, it doesn't fit because it doesn't make any goddamn sense. But Tucker's other, you know, big project has been the United States is becoming feminized. Men can't be men anymore. This was him, right? About the Chinese, the Chinese military. They don't have any confusion about who's a man and who's not. And they're going to be taking over the country because of this. So, like, he ties in, you know, nationalism with his concept of masculinity with, yeah, but it's also contradictory because apparently it was supposed to just be the flu and you were supposed to be able to get over it. And they were all cheering Trump on for essentially getting COVID and saying that it wasn't that big of a deal. I guess, you know, Trump's almost a woman.
Yeah. You know, Ella, when I had swine flu back in the day, I did really get in touch with my feminine side over that weekend. So
did you paint your nails?
Yeah. Paint my nails, watch some Sex in the City.
But there could be something to it. I accidentally got spoiled. Somebody shared a meme, and I had, it's like the new Sex and the City just came out. Please don't share memes with spoilers in it. All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by Matthew Stewart, author of The 9.9%, The New Aristocracy That Is Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. Quick break, be right back. We are back, and we are joined by Matthew Stewart, author of The 9.9%, The New Aristocracy That Is Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. Matthew, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, of course. I'm excited to talk about your book because I would imagine that you get this all the time. When I initially read the title, I thought that it said the 99% because, you know, just of the language that we've been that we've been engaging in since Occupy or the Bernie Sanders campaign as well. We're kind of taught to see income inequality as the 1% versus the 99%, which is helpful when you're just starting to think about inequality. But your book slices the pie in a different way with the tippy top, but then the 9.9% and then the rest of us. So take us through that initial calculus, if you could.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that are not quite right about that usual story. And one is the math. I'll go through that. But there's a deeper point, which is that it kind of frames inequality about as an issue to do with them, just a crazy small number of super rich people. And they are part of the problem, but the math points in a different way. And that was my goal, was to use the math to change the frame. So the math looks like this. Over the last 50 years, there's been a huge increase in economic inequality. We all know that. We're back to where we were in 1928. But it turns out that all that increase happened in the top 0.1%, all the relative increase in wealth. And it also turns out that not everybody down below lost. So it was the bottom 90% who ended up basically yielding to that top 0.1%. And then in between you have, do the math, it's 9.9%. And that group turns out to be the wealthiest collectively in our society. So if we had a dollar to give to the rich guy and we would basically give a dollar to the 90%, so that's sort of 900 people on one side and one on the other, each with a dollar, that group in the middle, the 9.9% or in the upper middle, would get $2.50. And it's held steady over the last 50 years. But as I say, the main point is to kind of change the frame a bit, because it's not that everybody, the issue is that our society is really organized around people making it into the 9.9%. That's kind of the American dream. And that dream has really changed. So I'll give you one other piece of the math that's important. That's that if you look at the ratio in wealth between the 9.9% and the 90%, 50 years ago, that was about 10 to 1, roughly. That's how much you'd have to increase your wealth to move from the middle of the pack of American society to this top group. And now it's 24 times. And my basic argument, I spend a whole book on it, is that when you change the math at that fundamental level, it changes our lives in a lot of ways. It changes the way we think. And that's, you know, helps us figure out why it is we're having so much difficulty facing so many crises, but also having so much difficulty addressing obvious problems.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of centers on some of my frustrations with, I think, you know, I'm in favor of a wealth tax, for example, but there is this, like, very, just targeting billionaires or just targeting the very top, which I want to do as a supplement, is insufficient because of this, like, very insular top, you know, 9.9% group that you reference here. And you mentioned how it's largely, well, it's been incredibly durable for the past 50 years. Tell us a little bit about how this group kind of codified itself.
So there, it's one of these things that's it's kind of obvious if you look around you, but most people don't really take the time to look. And in a way, that's the issue, right? It's the invisibility of how it all happens. But one area in which it clearly happens is in our neighborhood system and our you know, the way we divide up the real estate world, right? So what a defining attribute of the membership or the people who make it into this elect group in American society is the people who live in the right neighborhoods and basically have homes that are appreciated in value. I think we like to interpret that as just kind of like the tides rising. It's inevitable. What's the way the market works? But it's actually a lot more complicated, and there's a lot more complicity in that, because in fact, those neighborhoods are often good precisely because the people in them have the political power to restrain development, to use zoning laws to keep people out. And in fact, you know, in the big scheme of things, they've been successful in keeping people out, driving the prices up, and creating a very divided society. It's also been important with racial division, with educational division. That's just one part of the story. Then there's this educational component, which is really important, where we've managed to create a society in which if you can go through the right channels and basically are born to the right kinds of families, you can go through a certain educational system that will enhance your prospects. And if not, you will either not get a higher education or you will get an expensive one that will put you in debt and keep you on the other side. There are also important cultural differences, you know, the attitudes towards raising families in particular that have sort of distinguished this group. But all of these things, I think, have kind of crept up on us slowly. And more than we appreciate, they are they're really consequences of rising inequality. I mean, I think we often tell the story in reverse. We think, well, we're so smart that we've made ourselves wealthier as a special group. But the reality is more that the money appeared largely through structural problems in the way our economy is organized. And then we came up with rationalizations for it later.
Yeah. You touched on it a bit there, but the child raising kind of as a sport dynamic is something I'd love to talk about now, because I really did appreciate how you both have this, you have the scientific, like, mathematical approach to this, but also kind of a sociological focus on this particular group and what characterizes them. So it's easily identifiable outside of the bank number or the wealth accumulation, because that culture of parenting, I mean, it's something I certainly recognized, and that was your focus in chapter two. Tell us a little bit about that part of your book.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I came into this project really from two very different angles. One is that I was studying the Civil War, the struggle over slavery. So that was, and I saw an oligarchy there. I saw the story of inequality. And then that's completely irrelevant to your question. The other angle, though, was parenting. So I was involved in this parenting race. And it was, it struck me as being profoundly insane. I mean, the things that people are going through to, you know, get their kids into the, you know, national fencing competition and, you know, to curate every experience of their lives and to protect them from all conceivable risks. I mean, some of it can be helpful to kids, but a lot of it just clearly isn't. A lot of it's driven by this overwhelming anxiety. So that's what drew me into it. And there's a pretty short and simple analysis that I think explains most of it, not everything. It turns out that if you look at the sociological evidence across countries, countries that have high inequality tend to develop these kinds of extreme parenting practices. And then countries where there's a greater degree of equality or a higher sense of fairness, the parents take a somewhat more relaxed attitude. I don't think that means that they're bad parents. I just think it means that they don't feel that intense pressure to make sure that the kids move ahead. And I guess the final really important aspect of this is that for a small group of people in our society, it can make sense. So if you are in that 9.9%, maybe in the top 2 or 3%, you can afford the everything you need for supreme parenting. You know, you can get the nanny and maybe you can pay for the private school and you can buy that, you know, educational holiday in the Galapagos or whatever it is that you need to make sure that the little one is the perfect child. But it's pretty unrealistic for most of American society. And that the problem is that a huge part of American society is bought into that value system, but they don't have the money to pay for it. And there's this kind of unwillingness to recognize that we're setting up a model that's supposed to work, you know, in some fantasy land, but won't actually work in real life.
There's also just, I mean, to me, the narcissism of it is a little perplexing. Like, my child needs to be the perfect, you know, there's a striving, and that's why I guess you can categorize it as an aristocracy in that sliver of the population. Like, that. There is like this idea to not just keep up with the Joneses, but to present this your child almost as a human trophy of your wealth or your status, I guess. And it's just not that way, even though those same standards are applied to the rest of the population. It's just not the way. It's not feasible.
Yeah, no, you said a couple of things that really get me worked out. Very interesting. Narcissism, first of all, let me just say in a general way, there's plenty of evidence historically and culturally to suggest that there is a strong connection between these kinds of narcissistic disorders and rising inequality, because people understand that as the competition gets more intense and as it gets less fair, they need to build up these identities and then protect them. And so you get this kind of narcissism in this context. Then the other thing that you mentioned, which is really critical to understand, is social mobility. So the backstory about the United States is that this is the land of the free and you can make it if you try. And, you know, we're super mobile is the story. The facts are completely different from that. It turns out that our social mobility is substantially lower than that of many other countries, other countries that historically have had low social mobility. So we're lower than most of the European countries, certainly lower than Germany and the Scandinavian countries. We're lower than Japan. We're lower than Canada. And a significant aspect of that is it turns out that the least mobile people of all are the people in the top 10% and then in the bottom 10%. And as far as the top 10% goes, it's pretty straightforward how that's happened. We've got a wonderful selective university system that, you know, produces fantastic educations, but it is, it makes an effort to include some representatives from the bottom, but overwhelmingly it's serving that top decile. In addition, there are other advantages that these families on top can offer their offspring, the connections, the residential locations, you know, the color of their skin to some extent, and all these things lead to a pretty low, relatively low degree of mobility compared to other countries. And unfortunately, it turns out that again, as inequality rises, this effect becomes stronger. The richer groups are effectively even better able to protect their status and entrench themselves. So that's a big story about what's happening now.
You mentioned the university system. I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. I mean, we covered, I guess, the first half of it, which is the curating of the child's experience to lead them to the eventual pinnacle of the college experience, which better be an amazing one, because that reflects on me as the parent. And that's also, I think, an identifiable trait if we're looking at this group sociologically.
Yeah, so education is really critical to this whole story. I mean, it's part of the narrative of the group as a whole. I mean, there are many narratives, but the most important one is that we're special because we're educated, that education gives us merit, distinguishes us, and it explains why we earn so much money. The facts don't really support that. But more than that, more importantly, they also distract from a more real and less fortunate narrative about United States education over the last century. So one of the big accomplishments of the U.S. Starting in the mid-19th century was to create a public university system. And I think by the middle of the 20th century, or the third quarter of the 20th century, it was successful in a limited way. It was you know, obviously discriminatory in many ways, but it nonetheless provided a public higher education to a large group of people and increased social mobility. What's happened in the last 30 or 40 years is a significant reversal. We still have public universities, except they're not really public. They're mostly paid for, or at least more than half is paid for now by students. And then even worse, we've kind of created a privatized a segment within the public universities, sort of super elite sections that behave like private universities. And then we have a private selective university system on the side. So the net result is that instead of having a public higher education system that we were developing for a while, and as a number of other countries have, we have an effectively privatized system that works very well for a small number of people to make it to the top, works reasonably well for wealthy people who are able to push their kids through, and then saddles significant numbers of the broad mass of Americans who pursue higher education with excessive debt and inadequate career prospects. So the education system, from being a kind of engine of mobility, has turned into an engine of class reproduction. And just as a final point on this, is why I think it's interesting to focus on the 9.9%. When you talk about it to people within this group who are aspiring to it, they tend to think that the university issue is purely about admissions to these super selective universities. You know, who gets into Harvard and so on. And that's an example of an incredibly inward focused, narrow perspective on the problem. Those selective universities represent a very small part of our university system. They're really relevant only for how they explain the ways in which the rest of the thing is kind of screwed up. So, and it's that kind of blindness, that idea that, well, we can solve all the problems by tweaking the admissions policies of the Ivy League or something like that, is, I think, part of the problem that we face.
I mean, it's like pretty much most of college that applies to like this specific, the selectiveness that also codifies like the same class standards for the 9.9%. I mean, it's, as you say, it's systemic. It's not just the Ivy League. And like, that's why I get, you know, I'm so cynical sometimes, but I see like feel good stories about, you know, this kid came from nothing and went to this school, and like the entire, that exact class of people cheers on that kind of individual story, and makes a movie out of it and options it immediately. It's just like, that's just built to reinforce the fact that you think that the way that you're participating in society is somewhat earned and special.
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. And those stories, honestly, they are inspiring. I shed a tear over them too. I mean, they're good. I mean, in themselves, it's wonderful. If you see, a young person with no advantages, their father was an unemployed taxi driver or whatever, and they make it through and they get the scholarships. I think that's fantastic. And I wouldn't want to disparage those, but you're right. Those narratives, they're the Horatio Alger, rags to riches things that ultimately are used to validate an unjust system. I mean, it's that's why it's important to step back and look at the bigger numbers and see how many Horatios there are out there and how many people are basically are not going to make it that way.
You touched on the racial element a little bit earlier, but just how it's not shocking that there are extreme racial divisions in this 9.9% group and that it's mostly white. Tell us a little bit about your research in that area and what you found.
Yeah, so there are many overlapping issues here. First, in terms of the numbers, it's hard to get really super solid numbers on it, but the best I can figure out is that African Americans represent about 1.7% of the top of the 9.9%, whereas they account for about 13 to 14% of the general population. Latinos are about the same, 1.9%, and account for a slightly larger percentage of the population. So huge disproportion. The 9.9% is basically 90% white, the general population, or the 90%, let's say, below, are actually about 65% white. So that's, first fundamental fact. You just have to accept that that is what is really happening in our society. There are many explanations for it. No doubt discrimination is still a big part of the story. Historical discrimination is also very clearly a big part of the story because real estate is a real factor in separating the 9.9% from the 90%. And what the real estate numbers show is first that white people tend to own homes much more than black people. And studies also show that essentially equivalent homes between white and black neighborhoods are worth, according to one study, $48,000 less in neighborhoods that are identified as majority black. And there's even some further studies that suggest that individual homes may be have lower value if the owner happens to be black. So those are real estate's a big part of the story, and that's obviously a kind of reflection of discrimination in the past and discrimination in the present. But there's a lot of complexity to this story, and the one that strikes me and I wanted to draw attention to, it's very hard to cover it in a podcast, so I appreciate you allowing me to go on and on. It's that often what is more interesting or should be more concerning is the way in which we frame the race questions. And there's a tendency within the people who are in the 9.9% or buy into the culture of the 9.9% to frame race questions in a way that excludes economic issues, that basically treats race as a kind of isolated category that you can, and racial discrimination is something that you can solve and fix for. It's something that happens in individuals' heads. You can examine it and treat it independent of economic class and also independent of politics and of the politics that follow from economic conflict. And I think that that's profoundly misguided, and it leads to a misunderstanding of and false solutions to race problems in the United States. It's a really it's a complicated story to get out. I wish I could sum it up a little bit better, but do you have any thoughts on it?
No, I mean, I think I wanted to, well, one, I think what you said is true, and the home ownership piece and the neighborhood piece, and like, we don't talk enough about redlining in this country, and also what suburbia has done to codify, like, this very, I've said codify maybe seven times today. Now I'm realizing it. I'll try not to, but to cement like this exact, class of people that you're talking about. So I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit more, because that's obviously an economic problem as well as a racial problem together, and they're inextricable.
Yeah, so I mean, there's interesting work on this. There's been some great investigations of redlining in the past. And there's a book, and an author's name is escaping me right now, but it's sort of a central text in this, definitely has a lot of useful information in explaining how the redlining in the past sort of carried on into the present and has consequences. But then there's this other interesting kind of analysis that shows how the dynamic works now. And it's basically, it runs through tipping point ideas. So you have neighborhoods that are, that let's say used to be all white. And then they start to become a little more diversified. They and that tends to be fine in terms of real estate values up to a point. And then when that point is reached, and the point depends on the region, because regions behave differently, neighborhood can slide all the way to the other side, and then suddenly all the values go down. You know, once it becomes less than a certain percentage white. So, and as you can imagine, if that process plays out in some large number of neighborhoods across the country, what that effectively means is that non-white people who are buying into neighborhoods have a much greater risk of facing a significant downturn, whereas the people, mostly white people, but not all, because some number of non-white people will be able to buy into the white neighborhoods, will tend to see an appreciation in their values. And so they will, you know, succeed in joining the desirable class.
Yeah. And the concept of risk is something that is, I think, a theme in your book, and correct me if I'm wrong, but just the idea that risk is very much minimize for this top 9.9% class, but for the rest of the people striving to participate in the class, that class, which is again very difficult to achieve, if not impossible for a great majority of the 90%, that the risk that is taken on to participate is much greater and can lead to disastrous consequences.
Yeah, and here's really an interesting way of getting at that. You know, it's very hard to talk about risk in a quantitatively rigorous way, but what you can quantify, I think what we're all familiar with, is that there are various interesting health disparities, very alarming health disparities in the United States, and they map, unfortunately, pretty well into economic class. Now, it turns out that health issues are, to simplify a lot, the single biggest link or explanatory value for health issues is stress. And stress is essentially a measure of risk. So what we've got is an economy and a system that may be distributing income at levels that is above the poverty line for most people, but it's distributing risk and consequently stress in an even more uneven way than it is the incomes. And that then leads us to a misunderstanding. We think, oh, well, the average income in this area is above the poverty line, so therefore everybody must be happy, right? But it turns out that they're not. And the aggregate way to tell is basically to look at and see that there's a tremendous amount of stress producing a tremendous amount of ill health. And then, of course, if you look at it in a more granular way, you can see it. You can see that basically a lot of the workers in our economy with the lowest incomes are also the ones who have the least control over their schedule, who have the least certainty about the tenure of their position. You know, they can be fired at a moment's notice. They can be told they're going to have to work a different shift all of a sudden. They have the least health insurance, the least support. And so they, even if their income manages to kind of make it to a certain average over an extended period of time, they're facing a lot of risk. And then what happens on the other side with the 9.9% is the 9.9% have figured out how to pad their lives and live within, you know, nice cushy rooms where no one's ever going to get hurt because you just bounce off the walls. I guess that brings up this other thing that's important in my book, not just the risk, but invisibility, right? Basically, the people who tend to make it just don't get what life is like outside of their padded rooms.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded there was a Jacobin piece from a few weeks ago about stress being a collective issue, not just an individual one, and how, like, basically corporate stress management techniques are so isolated from the reality of what causes stress for majority of people. It's like treat this on like an individual basis as opposed to an understanding that this is a part of like this exact unequal system that you mentioned, which brings me a little bit to where I want to go, which is to apply a bit more to the present day, 2020. Well, not that your book didn't, but just to talk a little bit more about what you said in the context of the pandemic and also the resurgence of labor that we're seeing a little bit happening right now and this larger consciousness that's happening with labor. What did you find in studying this aristocracy and then also the comparatively to the rest of society in response to the pandemic, and how did that maybe shape your thinking about some of this?
So the pandemic is really interesting in this context because on the one hand, it has increased inequality on paper substantially. But on the other hand, it has shaken consciousness in some way. And for me, that's just like at an abstract level, that's really interesting because my main argument goes a little bit in the opposite direction. I've been essentially saying that for the most part, the consciousness tends to follow the inequality. And here we've got a situation that that seems to work in the reverse. Of course, I think it's working in the reverse because even though inequality has increased on paper, in a, you know, sort of financial sense during the pandemic, the shifts that we're seeing may have this certain positive side in that they portend, hopefully, potentially a somewhat more egalitarian outcome in the long term. And I'll mention a couple of things that I thought were particularly interesting. Like, I think the wave of strike action that was happening in the United States earlier in the fall, I think that the so-called Great Resignation, I think these are, you know, fundamentally positive developments. One of the biggest stories of the last 50 years is this decoupling of labor productivity from labor wage increases, and it's basically the result of a disempowerment of labor. And anything that brings a little power back there makes the equation a little more fair between labor and capital, I think is going to be a good thing. And I think the pandemic, you know, could contribute to that. As far as its impact on the professional and managerial types who are the backbone of the 9.9%, it was pretty easy for most 9.9% in relative terms, at least of a certain age and above, to adapt to a life at home and on screen, at least quite a bit easier than doing frontline work. But I think it also did come with some, increased awareness, an increased awareness of our interdependence. The way we talk about health now, I think, is dramatically different. I didn't see the piece that you're referring to, but the understanding that health is essentially something we pursue collectively, and health issues like stress are issues that we have to solve in some sense collectively. I think before the pandemic, you could argue that in a theoretical way and not many people would buy it. I think now you can argue it in a pretty visceral way. I think we all at some level now get that, everybody's behavior in some way contributes to and can help solve the pandemic issue.
You mentioned the term professional managerial types, which, we often use on this program and in just political discourse, because it made me think of a question I'd forgotten to ask earlier, because I wanted to see if you could touch on how this 9.9% reveals itself or how it breaks down along regional lines. Because, in my mind, of course, I'm envisioning suburbs of major metropolitan areas, but is that an accurate vision, or is it more dispersed throughout the country than I'm realizing?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me ask you first, when you speak about the professional managerial elites, are you speaking about them in a harsh tone of voice or in a friendly and welcoming one?
Definitely not in a friendly and welcoming one.
Okay. All right. So look, the 9.9%, if you understand it as a wealth distribution or an income distribution, it's got a lot of people it's dominated by professional and managerial types. But it doesn't consist entirely of them. And there's going to be a lot of small business owners, a lot of retirees, and other people like that, who we scattered around the country. But that's, figuring out the components of a particular part of the wealth distribution isn't as interesting as figuring out how this accumulation of wealth in certain places is shaping our culture. And it's in that respect that the political and managerial elites have a very special and distinctive role to play. And here, I think the really interesting and unfortunate story is that while there is a role, I think, in any modern society for something that you can call professionalism or something that you can call managerialism, I think that those roles break down. They become dysfunctional. They become parasitic under the conditions of rising inequality. Because what happens is that the professions, instead of, realizing whatever professional values they're trying to realize, which I think are often necessary given the imperfection of markets and the need for, communities to sort of trust people. In the case of rising inequality, what tends to happen is that those professions will become increasingly self-serving. They'll figure out how to protect themselves at everybody else's expense. So in the United States, a classic example of that, I'm afraid to say, is physicians. I mean, yes, we are all supposed to love our doctors, and then usually individually they're okay, but they've managed to set up a kind of guild that keeps the number of physicians down. So actually fewer physicians in the United States than there are in many other countries. And that's one of the reasons why they get paid twice as much here as they do in other countries. And even so, our health outcomes are not as good as they are in other countries. So that's just one example. There are many other examples, so I don't want to pick on just them. And then the same thing happens with the managerial elite. And there it's just so kind of obvious that you just have to scratch your head and wonder, why we even need to talk about this. I mean, we all know the compensation patterns in senior management. I mean, it's preposterous. The drug company CEOs, I believe last year took home, actually last year's not a good example because they took home even more given all the unusual stuff. In previous years, they were taking home about $1 billion a year. That's 20 individuals or 60 individuals taking home $1 billion a year, which was more than the CDC was spending on significant parts of preparing for a pandemic and so on. I mean, it's just preposterous when you go back in time, or even when you look at other countries, you find that there's no justification for this kind of egregious, excessive compensation. It's all clearly the result of a captured market and a kind of basically corrupt system. And so the question is, why does it persist? Why can't we just talk about it in a plain way? And I think that part of it is because the ideology of the 9.9% keeps on telling us that no. If you succeed, if you make money, it's because you're really just incredibly good. I mean, Bill Gates, for example, he made all that money, but it must mean that he's a really good programmer. He must be about a million times better than any other programmer or coder you've ever seen, right? And it's just it's crazy, but that ideology of merit and the market myth sustains that professional and managerial elite and allows them to become parasitic in this context of rising inequality.
Well, Matthew Stewart, the book is called The 9.9%, The New Aristocracy That is Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. Matthew, thank you so much for your time today and the discussion. Really appreciate it.
Great. Well, very glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap things up. We are back. We are back. We touched a little bit on the labor consciousness during that interview, but I wanted to highlight this. More Perfect Union, an organization that you should definitely be following on social media because they've been putting out great pieces specifically on the union resurgence in the country. They've been following these labor movements on the ground, including the Starbucks unionization effort. They spoke with a former Starbucks manager named Brittany Harrison, and she revealed to them that she was fired after, helping expose Starbucks' union busting. Brittany has cancer. She was also forced to work as she was feeling incredibly sick from cancer, and she tells her story here.
So October 14th, we had this meeting that was supposed to be about the fall launch, but it wasn't. And I was like, yeah, I need to record this meeting because I'm going to have to pull off and support my team. I'm going to need to refer back to this. I don't want to miss anything because this is such an important launch. And so I started recording. I did not realize what I was going to record.
We're a huge company. You'd love to get a hold of us. How much money they would make off of us.
The meeting started with my district manager saying, let's talk about what's going on in Buffalo. It kind of all unraveled from there, and they started talking about the union, why the union is bad, why the union doesn't align with Starbucks' missions and values, why partners who want to be part of the union aren't true partners to Starbucks. The union was painted in a very negative light, which made me uncomfortable because I have family that's in union. And so I'm sitting there while she's talking about how unions are like the Catholic Church because you have to talk to a priest if you want to talk to God, just like in unions, you have to talk to a union representative if you want to talk to anyone. None of this makes sense. None of these things are appropriate to say. And you're saying how all of these partners want more than what they deserve? I was asking to have fewer days. I was asking for what my other options were. I was told I could go on a leave of absence, but those are unpaid. And also you would have to pay your benefits out of your own pocket. And also you couldn't get a second job because then Starbucks wouldn't be required to give you benefits, which obviously wouldn't work for me because I can't be unpaid and paying bills, right? I remember calling my district manager in tears. I was like, I don't have family. I don't have friends. I have no one. What am I supposed to do?
All right, let's pause there. If you want to see the full video, you should go over to More Perfect Union. But obviously, it's incredibly disturbing. And like, I just keep hearing echoing in my brain, even from Howard Schultz's presidential run, but before that as well. Starbucks, most progressive corporation in America, Starbucks treating its employees correctly, able to be a multinational corporation in this day and age of corporate malfeasance, and actually is providing for its employees. And obviously it's not the case. Like they can do all these racial trainings. They can allow in New York City anybody to use your bathrooms, even if you're not a customer and you can't buy anything. But when it comes to, like, I mean, they literally touted that, and that is a good thing for houseless people in the city. Right, I understand
like,
that.
But that is another thing. Like, they're part of that problem that Denver built the public bathrooms in the first
yes,
place, and they get business from that.
Yes, exactly. And so, for the most part, that is really just the issue is that we don't have any public spaces in this country. And so, like, they can respond and do, you know, like, I just pulled up an article from the HR Digest. Starbucks once again sets precedent as most progressive company in the world, and it's because of just from a public relations perspective, they're happy to have that branding. But when it cuts into their bottom line, oh boy. And that's what you're going to see with, like, firing and retaliating against a woman who has cancer because she exposed that effort.
And you see how these things compound, too. Like, the way she said, I was offended by what they're saying about people in unions because I have family in unions. Unfortunately, that's not an experience I have. Like, I don't know. I'm from North Dakota. I don't know anybody. The closest I knew to somebody in a union was a guy on my block who worked for the railroad. And that's why, like, these victories can, even though we're so far behind, like, I think 1.2% of food and drink workers like this are in a union. But if you can start to build that, so all of a sudden people know somebody who's in this scary union that, again, like, people are saying is between you and God somehow, as if you have unfiltered access to a God through your boss somehow, when you don't have a union, like, it's just ridiculous. But yeah, I think that was, I mean, and always film your boss when they're doing stuff like this too. That's another good thing, is film them like they're cops.
I'm looking at some of the international statistics on unions just to make that, yeah, I got it, Bradley, don't worry. Just to hammer that home. In Iceland, over 90% of total employees are in labor unions. Canada, it's 26.5%, which is low compared to a lot of other European countries. UK, 24.7%. The United States is down at 10.6%. And that's the result of a many years long effort in that area. And when you see these changes, as Matt said, it can have generational effects, because if you know somebody who's in a union and you have that literacy and there's that skeleton there for you, you're more likely to understand your rights and push for unionization in your workplace.
And if the internet offers any opportunity, it should be, as far as democratized communication go, it should be these narratives of the workers rising up against their bosses. That's, I think, a good aspiration for us all.
All right, folks, we are going to head into the fun half now. But first, Matt, how was Left Reckoning last night?
Left Reckoning was great. We had Tom and Isha John on to talk about Barbados going republic. Is it as significant as it sounds? In some ways, it's great, of course. In other ways, there's a lot of work to be done. We talked about Mia Motley as a leader. You know, she's a very good sort of on the foreign for international relations realm. Is she quite as good domestically, or maybe not? Tom and Isha has an amazing amount of wisdom in these topics, so I would encourage everyone to check that out. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We got into Innes Kanter and his not willing to talk about the China stuff on the court with LeBron, apparently. If you want to get access to David and I's take on Innes Kanter's.
What do you mean on the court from the bench?
Exactly. Well, there was two clips. There was him on the bench not saying anything, as I forget who at the other Celtics player was talking with LeBron. And then there was another one where Innes really avoided LeBron on the court. So, we talked about that. I gave my talk about why it's annoying to, if we're going to discuss the possibility of ethnic genocide or cultural genocide in China, I'm open to hearing information about that, because I think that's a pattern that great powers do. Why does it always seem to come from people that want to deny those genocides here, and indeed, like, deny teaching of those things?
Do you think Lauren Boebert voted yes on that that sanctioning of Chinese products in the House, as she accuses Ilhan Omar
I'm all for expansive definitions of genocide, because I think we need to come to grips with how regularly nations do those things, but not with fucking Marco Rubio. But anyway, we talked about the Innes Kanter thing. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to hear a take there.
Innes Kanter freedom. Please do not.
I'm not going to use his. I'm not going to say that. No.
Matt and Brandon, how are you guys?
Hey, doing good. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
Doing well. You're in the festive spirit. Look at that.
Yeah, stocking behind you, Brandon. Very cool.
The war on Christmas has been reignited. So, you know.
Reignited?
Reignited.
There's a flame. There's a, I mean,
yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Good job.
Are you dropping Easter eggs about your involvement or lack of involvement potentially? I mean, I'm not saying, but I'm just saying.
Well, I mean, I think the proof behind him shows where his allegiance lies on this war on Christmas. So I don't think that was him at all.
Nah, overcompensating.
The war on Christmas, I think, is always raging in my heart. So, you know, I'm glad that it's now raging in the streets.
Binder, what's good. Happening over on Doomed? And I'm incredibly excited about something new that you might be launching soon. Every time I see you tweet about crypto, I'm like, whoop.
Yeah, I've heard that it's been mentioned on this very show since I've made that announcement / hint about my new show, which nothing concrete in terms of launch yet, but it will be in the coming weeks.
Anything just there that I shouldn't have?
No, that was all fine. Nothing more that I said than last week.
I forget if that was in public or in private. That's like
no. I think most people know now that I'm gonna do something. They just don't know what what it's called and when yet. So yeah, it's coming, so stay tuned. But tonight at youtube.com/MattBinder, I will have the Gilded Age podcast on. That's Walker Bragman and Alex Koch. And we will be talking about the, quote unquote, lefties. And I use that term very loosely, but there's a bunch of people on the left who've been really dabbling, and maybe dabbling is being too kind to them, but dabbling in anti-vaxxer, COVID denialism. And it's not good that people are spreading this sort of stuff, especially people who supposedly care and have leftist ideologies. And we'll be talking about that tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, youtube.com/MattBinder.
And Brandon, anything happen over on the discourse that you want to plug?
I do, absolutely. Tonight, I'm going to be re-uploading one of our archived episodes that was taken down a few months ago from, you know, our SoundCloud feed regarding the Russiagate conspiracy that we talked about when it first dropped. So this is an old archived episode, but it's 3 hours long, never released in full before. So you'll all be, you know, lucky to see how right I've been all along.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, you must be thinking that it aged well.
I mean, I can't remember what's in it, but yeah.
All right, folks, we are going to head into the fun half. We will be taking your calls, 646-257-3920, reading your IMs. See you then there.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.